Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Adventurers, The Improbable Rise of the East India Company, 1550-1650, by David Howarth, narrated by Michael Page. Preface. This is a book I have wanted to write for 50 years. It is about the romance of making money and the thrill of commercial history. As a research student in Florence in the early 1970s, I looked at documents about works of art exported from Tuscany to the court of Charles I, allocated a desk in the crepuscular Archivio di Stato at a time when that institution found itself between the Arno and the birth of Venus. Not even Botticelli could have lifted the sense of doom. Months passed, as did mood, from gloom to joy. Eventually, unable to find what I was looking for, I took myself off to the basement, where, after rummaging among closely packed files, I chanced upon something special, a letter where, stitched down the right-hand margin, were samples of all the silks that London had summoned from Florence in an attempt to get Van Dyck's sitters to dress a little better. Just short of 400 years old, so lambent were the corals, so subtle the laurels, these postage-stamp beauties could hardly have been exposed to light for more than seconds in those 350 years since someone had taken quill to paper and a needle to margin. Moving down the Arno from Florence to Livorno, such bales of silk became parcels of profit that, shipped aboard some Levant Company vessel, were bound for the Thames and the workshops of Whitehall Palace. 40 years later, and the scene changes to Euston Road in the rain. Here, in the British Library's India Office records, are to be found the papers of the East India Company, all 8 miles of them. Here, too, is a history in all its rustling, tumbling abundance. So huge a challenge to master as surely demands that Dante's exhortation, "Lasciate ogni speranza, voi ch'entrate," all who enter here despair, be tooled in gold above the issue desk. But just as in the Uffizi, so at the British Library, the possibilities appeared boundless. For these papers tell a tale unparalleled in any other early modern English archive. As with all the best stories, a study of the improbable rise of the East India Company throws up 100 questions to answer. I do not pretend to have mastered the British Library archive. No one can do that when those unmatched archivists who were trained by the Victorian Public Record Office threw in the quill at so impossible a task. And who can blame them? In transcribing merely the 10 years when a company factory existed in Japan, that is to say from 1613 to 1623, the British Library has found itself obliged in modern times to run to 2 fat volumes of 1,500 pages. As for the other, the record of those from whom the company was buying, I have relied on some of the small portion of primary sources in Asia that have been published to date. In what follows, there are many hostages to fortune between the red and the yellow seas, many questions begging for answers. But that is the inevitable consequence of so much about the East India Company that is of interest to every intellectual discipline. From its first days, the East India Company was much more than a commercial organization. It was part of the culture of the realm. Once established, the company became the investment of choice for the flower of commercial, cultural, and political life in an island fast gaining continental reach and global significance. If I have suggested that there remains the most formidable of challenges in acquiring a mastery of so voluminous an archive, what is within our grasp is a description of those stormy petrels, the company's fleets, as they ventured out over troubled waters. Any number of literary tropes, from Captain Hook to Captain Haddock, have made it too easy to assume that the servants of the company were splashed in brine and pickled in rum. It is a travesty of the truth. General Sir Henry Middleton, for which read Admiral in today's parlance, kept the most splendid of tables. Here was to be found the best of Tudor silver winking against the verdure hangings of Brussels. Within what was known as the Great Cabin, company captains would entertain guests dressed in such splendour as to have made the costume galleries of the Victoria and Albert Museum look like a charity shop. But beyond show, there was performance, and beyond cupidity, creativity. Middleton was a very fine musician, who loved the well-tempered viol, whilst many of the merchants he carried home more than was to be found in a ship's log. Take the merchant Augustine Spaulding, who first appears in the records in 1607 as the company's interpreter in Bantam. Spaulding not only tried to sell heavy West Country cloth in the middle of a monsoon, an epic challenge in itself, but hardly less painfully set about constructing a Malay dictionary for the use of mariners that he had translated out of a Dutch version taken from a primer in Latin. Far off the coast of Senegal, too, and on the company's fourth voyage, the ships put on the first performance on water of Shakespeare's Hamlet. In the months that separated the west coast of Africa from the north coast of Java, they took to a parley of instruments, believing that music soothed the soul of the most mutinous of crewmen. For all the cultural richness encountered on these earliest voyages, no visual trace remains. Such a lack of material is in marked contrast with what is to be found in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Here the heroics of the Dutch East India Company, the Verenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie, or VOC, are recorded in abundance. Part of the difference is because at that time the visual arts were much more sophisticated in Holland than in England. But in the grander sphere of nation-building and national rivalries, not until the East India Company annexed Bengal in 1757 did the English think ambitiously of territorial conquest. By contrast, however, and from its very foundation in 1602, the Verenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie's impulse was to manufacture national identity via the creation of colonies in the Far East. In early East India Company history, however, appeals to past glory or future greatness are as hard to find as the horn of a unicorn. What follows, then, is an account of the rise of England's most powerful overseas commercial organisation as it came to be defined in the perennial rivalry with the Dutch. This is less a tale of two nations than two companies whose activities had profound effects on the creation of respective empires in England and Holland in the early modern world, the one commercial, the other colonial. Introduction. Our story properly begins in a room in Westminster on the last day of 1600 with the formal launching of the East India Company, or EIC, under the sonorous title of Governor and Company of Merchants of London Trading into the East Indies. But that halcyon moment had been preceded by a number of discussions, the most important of which had been held on 24 September 1599, when 101 business interests had assembled, and the result of which was the issuing of the nascent company's first royal charter. Not all the congregants are identifiable, though some of the biggest names in the city lurked in the shadows of a long September day. Here we find men of both reputation and scandal. Take Sir William Cockayne, died 1626, who would be responsible for the biggest financial scam of the entire 17th century, when, in 1614, he convinced James I that English wool should be dyed at home, not as hitherto finished in Holland, before onward transmission to the markets of Europe. Cockayne's argument was that monies would be repatriated. Privately, he calculated that he might also fleece the Merchant Adventurers Company, which controlled the management of what was England's principal export. It proved a disaster, and by 1617 the adventurers had regained control just as Cockayne gained his evil reputation as the most grasping of the money men. Or Sir Baptist Hicks, died 1629, who, beginning a mercer, ended a viscount. Before reinventing himself as a great Gloucestershire landowner, Hicks had been notably grasping and much criticised for grinding his customers in his shop at the White Bear in Cheapside. Besides manipulating the money markets, Hicks had also massaged the crown with large cash loans, Sir Baptist's career perfectly illustrated how the princes of the city could become the potentates of the realm. The meeting's convener was the roistering Earl of Cumberland, died 1605. Most noble among sailors, most colourful of these movers, Cumberland thrust himself forward with as much gusto as any figurehead upon a ship. Later damned as a great but unamiable man, and one whose career admirably illustrates the difference between fame and virtue, Cumberland was ideally suited to get things launched. He had had a good war, celebrated for commanding the Elizabeth Bonaventure at the Armada in 1588, party to the famous capture of the Mai de Deus in 1592, lauded for leading a raid on Puerto Rico, his lordship had done well by England. Cumberland had courage, charisma, and a title. With such assets, indeed, he now managed to get the shareholders to fall into line like so many children on a Tudor monument. Soon enough, these men, and the very first investors were all men, though it would not be long before women took their place in the story, came to be referred to as adventurers. Such a name points not to exciting events at sea, though goodness knows many a shareholder would long for the outfit to be altogether more adventurous than any governor was ever going to allow, but rather the venturing of capital. The East India Company's roots ran deep in the loam of English commerce. By no means all who crowded into these inaugural meetings were interested just in money. The Sands and the Ferrars stood for rectitude more than reals, religion more than receipts. As an MP said, Edwin Sands would be the furious, highly charged leader of all those who despised the Stuarts and just about everything else to do with the country from whence the new dynasty had hailed. By contrast, Nicholas Ferrar was to be converted from rising to his feet at adventurers' meetings to falling on his knees in prayer after establishing the sequestered hamlet of Little Gidding, his little community of penitents chanting amidst the bulrushes which T.S. Eliot would immortalise in one of the great poems of the 20th century. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that in late 16th century England, the few thousand who ran the country were either drawn to, worked for, or envied the new overseas companies of which the East India was the latest and would become the most successful. Anyone who paid around £200 in subscription qualified as an adventurer, and so by rights would be admitted to the general court. At the meetings of all these shareholders or adventurers, factors' letters from foreign stations would be read out. Behind the arras, however, muttered the 24-strong court of committees. It ran things on a quotidian basis, taking all the important decisions, of which the most crucial was to make sure that it was given every means to emasculate the general court. The Court of Committees could always be relied upon to work hard at concealing what it felt the General Court should never know. Though the adventurers were well aware of this, with the exception of a disaffected minority who could never be reconciled to a culture of the nod and the wink, the generality knew better still that the gains to be made in throwing savings into the company meant it was best to overlook the Court's wilful exclusion. By 1610, only a decade since the company had first opened for business, traffic wardens employed to keep things moving in the gridlocked streets of the city found coaches backing right up Eastcheap. Every manner of royal and royal office holder was determined to become an adventurer. Who do we find pressing for entry? Here were Sir Francis Bacon and Thomas Hobbes, among the greatest thinkers of the age. Here, too, was to be found the entire judiciary. As for the servants of the royal household, adventurers ran from cook to chaplain via the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the royal librarian. This is not to say that all these men from high places had much or any influence on how matters were actually conducted. The East India Company's first governor, Sir Thomas Smith, died 1625, was obliged not only to manage a raft of competing interests, but also to thrust off those who thought themselves entitled to influence. How Smith set about trying to maintain the integrity of the company, with determination, if not always success, is clear from the way he managed to repel a peremptory demand of the Lord Treasurer, who, the court minutes record, uses much persuasion to the company to accept of the employment of Sir Edward Micklebourne on the voyage as a principal commander, resolved not to employ any gentleman in any place of charge or command in the voyage. Mr. Garway requested to move the Lord Treasurer to give them leave to sort their business with men of their own quality, and not to expect that they should make any further motion of this matter to the generality, lest the suspicion of the employment of gentlemen being taken hold upon do drive a great number of the adventurers to withdraw their contributions. It was not only the constant business of keeping sweet those who might become sour that represented a major challenge. Retaining the contributions of stakeholders who had ventured upon the company's first journeys was paramount, whilst encouraging others to chance their money too required all the skill and experience Smith had accumulated over many years as a successful governor and counsellor of earlier trading companies. Amongst these, the most notable with which Smith had had dealings were the Muscovy and Levant companies. Cartels in their own right, these two would provide critical experience to the nascent East India Company. Indeed, such avuncular advice was to prove essential not only to the launch but also to the very survival of this new venture. There was always strenuous debate as to how to get to those places where European wares might be offloaded at profit. Was it to be the Cape or the Cap, round the Cape of Good Hope or over the ice cap of the North Pole? The support of the Muscovy Company was essential for those who championed the possibility of either a northeast or a northwest passage over the Arctic to China, and who were prepared to embark on a highly strenuous journey. From the vastly experienced Levant Company, which had already been bringing luxuries from the Middle East to Europe for some 20 years, the company learned that the way to survive was to import in order to re-export. What came up the channel had to go out through the Pillars of Hercules, which was how Gibraltar was then described, and from there to Italy, Greece, and Turkey. But despite it being doubtful whether the company could have survived had it not been able to borrow invaluable experience from the Levant, relations were often strained. As for supplying the ships that might take English goods as far as Japan, this process exposed the thoroughly ad hoc nature of the business. Whilst everyone scrambled to load the three ships that would set out for the East at the end of February, there was every manner of thing posted from Stepney to Surat and Poplar to Penang. Not all was from England either. Whilst there would be a good stock of tin from Bodmin and curses from Woodbridge, there was also coral from Marseille and elephant's teeth, tusks, from Senegal, with which to make many an ivory throne. As for the company's ships, returning after upwards of 3 years cruising eastern waters, these would be loaded with indigo from Ajmer, silver from Japan, silks from Persia, cinnamon from Ceylon, cottons from Coromandel, and, as ballast, upwards of 80 tons of stone for every ship. This might then be donated to make walkways in the city. Victualling the fleets was a massive logistical challenge. To begin with, there was the issue of finding ships of sufficient size and seaworthiness. Less than 1 week before the departure in April 1601 of the first historic voyage, as the annual departure to the Far East was known, it was suddenly discovered that the Great Susan was so grossly overladen it would be lucky if she made Greenwich before sinking. What was to be done? Sir James Lancaster, Armada veteran and company general, scurried off to Gravesend to find a seaworthy vessel. No time to haggle, whipping out his purse, Lancaster offered a quick £300 to buy the gift. At 120 tons, she could just about be counted to get to the Azores, ploughing along behind her three sisters carrying what the main ships of the voyage could not. The receipt of her acquisition is minuted as late as 18 February, when the voyage should already have left. What is surprising about the launch of the East India Company is how little was planned and how less was prepared. Analyzing the company in these first chaotic years suggests just how wrong it is to think there was something inevitable about its so-called rise as a systematic monolith that was somehow predestined to govern India. Indeed, all too often, these early voyages only just got away in time to allow for a successful round trip. But as we shall soon discover, what successes they could be. Here was an outfit that ought to have been as solid as a bulwark. When a good return was achieved, profits were staggering. If the swabber aboard the good ship Peppercorn was crafty enough to steal just one bag of spice, he might expect to gain a 2,000% profit. But whilst returns were good for a number of years, by the onset of economic depression in 1618, what should have been a copper bottom became a rotten hull. Late arrivals, glutted markets, private gain, and a house divided between the Court of Committees and the General Court of Adventurers brought the whole show to the very verge of bankruptcy. But for all the difficulties, profits did accrue, and capital was accumulated. So, although painfully and laboriously, the company was able to conquer recession to become both secure and profitable. There is a strong case for thinking that the first of all these voyages was the most chaotic. 6 months before departure, the company owned not a single ship. None had been built and none were on order. To tackle the problem, a subcommittee set off to the docks of Deptford, Erith, and Gravesend. Overlooking the merits of the Mayflower, which instead of harvesting pepper in Malaya came to sow Protestantism in Massachusetts, the subcommittee lighted upon the Malice Scourge. This was a vessel of 600 tons owned by the Earl of Cumberland. Grudgingly, and only after a great deal of wrangling, a price of £3,700 was agreed. But that was far from fair. Waiting until the money was in the mattress, Cumberland told the company how they would be well advised to buy a water pump in case the Scourge decided to follow what men had feared the Great Susan was going to do and sink to the bottom of the Thames. As for the overburdened Susan herself, she belonged to Sir Paul Baining, who was another of those 101 first investors. The deal with Baining was that if the Susan made it home, he would buy her back at half price, never mind her condition. Such obvious conflicts of interest would stay with the company throughout its entire history. Nevertheless, if in 1600 no one was ready, the company found itself part of a world ready enough for bold enterprise. Overseas associations, of which the East India was to be one of the last, benefited from what had been the institution of new administrative structures following the accession of Henry VII in 1485. Eschewing ecclesiastical strictures about usury, the Tudor revolution in finance had seen the ruthless pursuit of other men's wealth. This it had done with strategies that were interim solutions to old problems, dilemmas that exercised the mind of administrators from one Cromwell to another. From Thomas in the 1530s, creating his new order of wealth, to Oliver in the 1650s, granting his new charter to the East India Company. How can a large organization generate profit and sustain solvency? These were acute questions faced by those who ruled England. Until, that is, the finances of the Crown were ordered upon something of a regular basis after the glorious revolution of 1688. Exactly a century before then, Lord Burleigh, chief minister to Elizabeth I, had been doing much to create the optimum conditions that would allow the overseas companies to emerge. It is no exaggeration to say that Burleigh changed the face of society. He was foremost in creating such a culture of adventurism as was well suited to the high-risk business of sailing eastward. No less important was the vastly enhanced sense of nationhood following the great deliverance of the Armada in 1588. Such an accretion of new commercial skills, so manifest a celebration of Englishness, created the necessary confidence in this high-risk enterprise. Accordingly, the company was able to attract vastly experienced men who had benefited from old lives at sea and new thinking about money, revenue raising, and company formation. English court and English commerce were more creatively entwined than in any other polity in Europe. Essential to the effectiveness, influence, and survival of the company would be its close and conflicted relationship with the executive. Elizabeth I bore down upon the company. For instance, she sent a letter from her Privy Council bemoaning Her Majesty's mislike of the slackness of the company during their first voyage, propounding unto them the example of the Dutch, who do prosecute their voyages with a more honourable resolution. Such an unambiguous rebuke was wholly different from James I's vacillation whenever he was to have dealings with this new outfit. The Stuart Crown not only insisted on being involved in company business, but it also conducted its own in such a way as to seriously undermine the bargaining position of the company with European rivals. Largely because of the way in which James I viewed the company, Governor Smith became enmeshed in things that had as much to do with foreign relations as overseas commerce. A constant fight between England and Holland, conducted now in London and then at The Hague, was just part of a larger battle between the city and the crown that would include much more than just commerce and taxation. The barbed relationship with the Dutch and the sulphurous dealings between James I and Governor Smith that Dutch intransigence did so much to provoke served to show how, from first bright morning, the company was a piece of state. The EIC belonged to the globe of politics as much as it did to the sphere of commerce. Many of those who attended those famous first meetings wanted to do more than simply sell pepper in Pudding Lane, buy estates in Kent, or help themselves to large parts of America. They wished to benefit the Commonwealth, something that had nothing to do with colonies. America appeared to be suitable in this respect, but only the seriously insane ever thought of laying down settlements upon the banks of the Tapti. The Tudor Commonweal meant social cohesion and the health of the body politic, and most definitely not the subjugation of others. But if very few were interested in settlements, the company was always in constant tension about the pursuit of wealth and the morality of profit. Critics deprecated how the company took irreplaceable specie out of the Commonwealth, constantly denouncing what they saw as a fatal weakening of the realm. Governor Smith's critics kept on telling him how once money had left the realm, it was not only gone, but gone forever, starting, as it sustained, a national debate about wealth creation, moving from bullionism to monetarism. The EIC and its troubles, the profits it made, the distrust it provoked, all this and more made it gather as it grew the best thinking about the wealth of the English nation. Thomas Munn, died 1641, headed up the company's departments of human resources and PR, an inspired choice and a member of the Court of Committees whose spate of publications prevented the company from dying of exposure beneath a hail of denunciation. So persuasive was Munn's rejection of bullionism that he is regarded as the most acute British thinker about money until Adam Smith established his preeminence with the Wealth of Nations, 1776. Questions about how economics worked, how to get rich, and still more important, how to stay that way, leached into the broadest possible social questions. Because the company attracted the Forbes list of Tudor England, it could never avoid public scrutiny. But soon enough, within the span of its first few years, a process began that might suggest how it would become a fourth estate, always in an uneasy relationship with the crown, which would strive to bend the company to its will, a parliament that resented its growing wealth, and a church that deplored its usurious ways. Throughout these early tumultuous years, the company bore a striking resemblance to one of its own ships trying to get to China over Russia. Searching for a passage through its difficulties, it found itself pressed from all sides, timbers groaning, orlops creaking and mizzens cracking. Everything looked doomed. And yet the Almighty read the company motto, Deo ducente nil nocet, with God leading, no harm arises, and heartily approved of what he saw. Often enough, Smith had absolutely no idea where he was going. How, then, could those 24 godly men comprising the Court of Committees have survived had they not believed that the hand of God was upon the wheel? This story begins with a survey of European transoceanic trade that had been developed by Portugal, Spain, and Holland before the East India Company opened for business. Such a survey exposes the nature of the challenge that the company faced in getting on terms.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?